I wanted to first get a sense of when you first became interested in mathematics.
That is a very long time ago. I always tell people it was in second grade, but now I remember telling the story more than I remember actually thinking it. But I do know that it was in second grade and reading like a book about Flatland. It was like a kid's version of Flatland. And I remember writing my name in these really long letters and putting on the desk and like looking, you know, to so that they would become little letters again. And I remember telling people that I liked this book, Flatland, and they said, well, then you like math. That's what you like. And then I would get lots of math books. Like the school would sell their old math books, and I would buy them with like my lunch money and then read all the math books. So I was very obsessive about reading a lot of math books.
Was there much interest in math in your own family?
My father had a bachelor's degree in math, but he didn't talk about it much or have a lot of math books around. But, you know, he thinks mathematically, maybe, and so maybe that was rubbing off. That's probably why there was a book about Flatland at all in the house. So it was lucky to have it just be there in the house. Right. So
now, in school, mm-hmm. Was the math encouraged, or did you find it discouraging?
No, I was not encouraged to do math at all. Mm-hmm. I actually remember in fourth grade, I worked ahead, right, because I was excited, and so I would go home and do, like, extra homework, and I would do all the problems, and I came in, I think it was around January, I had finished the book, right, and I said, I want to have the next book, and they said, you can't have the next book, you're now done with the book, no more book. And then later in the year, I remember that a bunch of boy students were given the next book. I remember being very angry about that. That was actually the only real time I ever had trouble being a girl, was in fourth grade. Other than that, it's been fine.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Connecticut, but in the eastern part of Connecticut, like where it's very unpopulated there. It's a very sparse area. So it was a very small town, maybe 1,000 people tops lived in my town, very isolated place to live.
So when you got to high school, mm-hmm. you could start making choices about what you wanted to take.
Yes. Well, we didn't have calculus in my high school, so I didn't have a lot of choices of what to take. But I did get to, like in middle school, I got to do math counts, and then in high school, I remember there was like a field trip to the Boston Museum where we saw like a lecture about topology and the coffee cup and the donut. And so I had occasional things where I got to be exposed to something mathematical. But that really, I really didn't get a chance to do it till college. Like I knew I wanted to do it and I would do stuff on my own, but there just wasn't that, it just wasn't part of school.
So was math a consideration when you were choosing your college?
Yes, as soon as I learned that you could major in math, I decided I wanted to do that. Uh-huh. And then, I didn't know that at first, actually, because people told me that I should be an astrophysicist. Like, if I liked math, then I should be an astrophysicist, and I didn't know what that was, but I kept telling people I was going to be an astrophysicist for a while, because that's what people said I should do. And then I found out you could actually major in math, and I said, okay, I want to do that. And then I found out you could go to grad school in math, and actually get paid to go to grad school in math. And so I said, okay, I want to do that. And I was really unaware of the process, mm-hmm. you know. And each step, somehow I would find out the next step and get mm-hmm. to do the next step.
How did you end up at the University of Chicago initially, right?
So my father actually had gone to the University of Chicago. So he really wanted me to go there. And so I did not want to go there at all because, of course, you're a teenager and you don't want to do what your parents did. So I said, you know, the only place I don't want to go is the University of Chicago. And then I remember that was back in the day when we didn't have the internet, and they would send you videotapes, mm-hmm. like VCR tapes. Right. And so I was getting these tapes from other schools, and they were all like football games and happy, you know, how fun it is to be there. And the Chicago videotape was just incredible. It's like, we don't go out, we just study all the time. You know, if you want to spend your money on going to college and then go to lots of football games, then don't come here. It's really harsh. And I thought, I want to go there. That's where I want to go. And then I was lucky enough to get in to go there. So that was a great opportunity to get to go there.
And did you find the math there, what you were looking for?
Oh, yeah, I got my butt kicked there. Yeah. I was really behind, you know, because it just didn't have this at my school. So I didn't have calculus. So I took a summer course in calculus, you know, just so that I would have some calculus. But it was very much like, you know, differentiate these polynomials. And so I got to Chicago and you have to take a test to see what class you're going to be in. And I took this placement test and I was just making up answers. Like, what's the intermediate value theorem? And I'd say it's the fact that between every two rational numbers is an irrational number intermediate to them. You know, like, I just made up. I think they liked that I made up lots of theorems. And so I got into honors calc, which had no place being, and everyone else knew everything except for me. I was the only stupid person in the class. I had to work so hard in that class. It was like taking six classes for me, but it was awesome. It was great. It was out of Spivak.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You survived, though.
I did. I think our first homework assignment, I had to prove using induction the fewest number of moves to solve the Tower of Hanoi puzzle. Mm-hmm. I had to figure out what that fewest number was and then prove it using induction. And I knew how to differentiate polynomials. It was very sad. So anyway, this whole, I'm telling you this, I guess, because the whole experience makes me really appreciative of students who are behind. You know, they're not stupid. Mm-hmm. They're just, maybe they haven't seen it yet, and so I'm really passionate about the students who aren't the rock stars, aren't superstars, and giving them a chance to mm-hmm. prove themselves.
But from Chicago, you found your way to graduate school.
Found my way to graduate school. Right, ended up at Duke for graduate school, and that was fine, and survived that too somehow.
So what was your particular interest by then?
Well, I was very interested in algebraic topology, so I was very much into topology. I took every topology course that one could take as an undergraduate, and then some independent study courses as an undergraduate. I graduated with like five different flavors of topology after I left, and so I thought that's what I wanted to do, and then I went to Duke. But of course, at that age, you don't really understand. You don't know anything. You're just a kid, you know. So I think I like this thing, but I go choose Duke, and it turns out that they're all algebraic geometers, right? But I didn't really know enough really to distinguish that when I chose to go there. But so I ended up doing my thesis was a lot more about algebraic geometry, and, you know, singular varieties and turn classes and. Just because of the people that were there, that's what I ended up doing, so, yeah.
Were there particular people that influenced you in which directions you went?
Oh, yeah, my advisor in graduate school. Oh, and I had an advisor in undergraduate, too, who begged me not to go into mathematics, saying that it was a lonely and horrible place. He was like one of the Dixon instructors at mm-hmm. Chicago, so it was sort of like a teaching postdoc or postdoc type position. He was miserable. And I had such a hard time, and he kept telling me, don't do it, you're just so lonely, and it's frustrating, and, you know, it takes you years to solve a problem, and then you just realize how stupid you were. You know, he was right about all that, but it just made me love it even more. The poor guy really tried to talk me out of it. And then in graduate school, my advisor in graduate school, I would have dropped out of graduate school so many times if not for my advisor, Bill Pardon, at Duke. He was great, and... a man of very few words, the opposite of me. Mm-hmm. Our meetings were like, I would talk and talk and talk and talk, and then he would just like nod at me. It's a very intimidating person, I found. But wonderful. I would not have made it through grad school if not for him.
So what were you looking for after grad school?
Well, by that point, I had discovered that I really liked teaching also, mm-hmm. which I didn't anticipate really liking. The field that I was in, you know, there were 10 or 12 people in the world that could understand what I wrote about, right? The small community, and they all lived in France, you know, I hardly ever would meet these people, and it was very lonely. You know, my undergraduate advisor was pretty right about that, you know, that it was very lonely, and I liked that, but I definitely needed to be in a place that... paid as much attention to teaching as to research. And that wasn't the case, I'm sorry to say, at a place like Duke, that's just not the case, right? I mean, the main focus is the research, and then if you can get your teaching out of the way as a grad student, you're not supposed to really focus on it. But I wanted to take both of those things seriously, so I was looking for this, like, 50-50 place, And James Madison University was a great place for that. I went there right out of grad school. I never had a postdoc. I started there right after grad school. And I think the people at Duke thought I had, like, dropped off the face of the earth, you know, because it's not the R1 community anymore. So I kind of left that, you know, you're sort of on this spiral in the R1 community, and I stepped off it somehow. So, but I'm happy, I'm glad that I did, actually, because I do a lot of different things. James Madison University let me do a lot of things poorly and get away with, you know what I mean? They were supportive of anything. I want to learn this now. Okay, fine, learn that.
And you seem to take advantage of it. You've got a wide variety of interesting and things not in sort of the mainstream of mathematical thinking or research.
Yeah, I like doing the things that other people think are jokes. I think that's like goal in life. Oh, you don't respect that? Oh, well, I'm going to do it then. And, you know, like it's like I'm rooting for the underdog all the time. Like, I can get math out of that.
I mean, to some mathematicians, recreational math is sort of a pejorative
term. It's very less than. And then to research Sudoku, which, like, you know, your mom can do, and people do on the subway, you know, just like normal people do it. So that's looked down upon, to study that. And so then I like to study that. I don't know, I'm a very difficult person, I think, now that I'm saying this out loud.
But it's the kind of thing that would be very attractive to students.
Yeah, and they love it. And so they don't think they like math, and then you can trick them, you know, into liking. A student actually told me that once. They said, Dr. Tallman, it was like in a liberal arts math class, you know. They said, Dr. Tallman, this is really interesting, but you're just tricking us. Like, you're making math sound really fun, and I know that if I just do math, that it's not going to be fun, and it's going to be a lot of stuff I don't understand, and you're trying to make us think it's going to be fun. He's very, very upset with me.
Now, you've also done, in terms of trying to improve, change the way things are taught and so on, in calculus in particular. How did those come about?
Well, that kind of comes from my background in a way, because so at Duke there was a calculus with pre-calculus class. So at Duke, I don't think we were allowed to offer a class below calculus, right? Because the admissions requirements are so high that we just didn't have these remedial courses. But we still had students that frankly needed a remedial class. But they had to take calculus. Everybody has to take calculus. So they had a calculus class that was sort of calculus and pre-calculus at the same time for students that couldn't do that. That was a very reform perspective class. And that's not really my flavor. So when I left graduate school, I wanted to repeat that kind of thing, calculus with pre-calculus, but from a more traditional standpoint. I mean, I like applications, but it's just not the way that I usually approach mathematics. I'll go with the theory first and then open it up to what can we do with it, rather than the other way. So, but I was very interested in this population, probably because of my own background, that other people would write them off. They said, well, we're never going to get a math major out of these students, so it doesn't matter what we do with them. And I really disagree with that. We've had kids go to graduate school, multiple kids go to graduate school that started with the calc with pre-calc class. The kids that, you know, they failed the placement test, just like I probably failed my placement test. And someone luckily put me in a class that was good for me. But I'm really passionate about defending those kids and making sure that they have a shot to do the Delta Epsilon proof serious math and not just get written off. Anyway, so that's why I did that, because I was very passionate about making sure those kids had a chance to do calculus.
But you went on, you wrote a textbook, or co-wrote a textbook?
Right, so I wrote a textbook that was calculus and pre-calculus together. But there was only Calc 1. It was one of those calculus one in a year things. And then the publisher said, well, you should write like the full 3-semester thing so people have something to go into after that. And being really stupid, I agreed to do that. It's so much work. I don't know what the heck I was thinking. But I got a co-author so that, because it's a much bigger project. So the Calc with Pre-Calc is my book, but then the Big Calc book is a co-author project. But my baby is really what I call the blue book, the one that's got the calculus and the pre-calculus at the same time. I love teaching that class. It's heartbreaking, but I love, the students are great. It's hard for them.
How do you find the writing process itself?
Well, I sometimes like it. You know what I don't like? I don't like looking for parentheses like, this curly bracket needs to be 5% larger because it doesn't cover the... I hate that stuff. It, mm-hmm. That bothers me. But the actual, like, so all that, like, fiddly stuff I sometimes don't like. But the, like, how to organize something so that it all makes sense and it's in the right order, it brings people on this, like, journey of learning about stuff. If they ever read it, the kids probably don't even read it. But if they read it, then they would go on this nice journey. I like that. And I like... you know, stupid stuff like making diagrams and formatting things, mm-hmm. ridiculous things. I like that too. So, but it's really hard. I don't know why I thought it would be a good idea. It
goes back sort of to your flatland.
Yeah.
Experience.
Well,
that's your journey, and well, no, that's
yeah.
your,
oh yeah,
the way the
mm-hmm.
book is put
yeah.
together. It is a journey.
It is a journey.
And
yeah.
looking at things from new perspectives. And
yeah.
How do you convey all that?
Yeah, although honestly, if you wanted to take people on a journey, a calculus book is like the dumbest thing you could write because mm-hmm. nobody reads that. I mean, somebody is reading it, but for the most part, you know, the instructors don't need to read it, and the students grudgingly sometimes read it, and mostly do the exercise. You know, like, it's not really a place to be appreciated. But I like writing it, and it's, I know a lot more calculus now than before I wrote it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because you have to hold that whole system in your head in order. And that was cool.
Mm-hmm. Now, how did you get involved with Sudoku?
Well, I tried to avoid it as long as possible. I could tell that was trouble and a half right there. You know, like,
yeah.
sometimes there are video games I'll refuse to play because I know I will not come out of them for 2 weeks, and I knew Sudoku was going to be like this, so I was trying not to learn about this thing. And then a colleague was like, you would really like this thing, and they gave me a puzzle. And so I did the puzzle, and my husband, who's a computer programmer, and I, we got a couple puzzles, and after a few of them, we were like, these puzzles are kind of all the same. You know, like, they're hard, but they're kind of, we're kind of doing the same thing over and over again. Wouldn't it be cool if the puzzle was, like, broken in this funny way so that we had to have a new technique? And so we started making all these new puzzles that were Sudoku-like.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly we had all these, I mean, that's what we did for fun. You know, like, but then that all of a sudden we have these puzzles. So we shopped it around, and a publisher decided to publish, like, Color Sudoku, which is this book of puzzles. And so then, you know, it's always better if you have a project for it to be related to all your other projects, otherwise you don't have time for your projects. So then I was thinking, you know, if I had an undergraduate that wanted a project, I said, well, why don't we investigate this new kind of puzzle? And that just kind of grew into more questions than I could ever possibly answer about Sudoku. I'm good at asking questions. I don't think I always... like, we didn't solve the problem that... There's, like, a group of mathematicians that were trying to solve a problem about Sudoku, and we didn't solve it. Somebody else ended up solving it. So we failed miserably. But it was fun to
work on.
Oh, yeah. We learned a lot. We got a few papers out of it, but we never solved, like, the problem. We wanted to solve that minimum clue conjecture, and then Gary Maguire did it with, you know, 700 million hours of computing time on supercomputers, and what he did was great. And then I could work on other things. Yeah, that was actually kind of nice.
The new thing, 3D printing.
The new thing, 3D printing, yeah.
How
yeah.
did that attract your attention?
Well, I wanted to make knots.
Uh-huh.
So I wanted to make these knots, these minimal conformation knots. I'm a surprisingly non-visual person. I'm very non-visual. Like, I have trouble rotating things in my head. Like, if I'm not physically looking at it, I don't have a visual sense of it. And so I really wanted these models, but, you know, if you just tie a rope, then you don't have a minimal conformation of something. You just have, like, you have the knottedness of it, but you can't, like, your nice copper
mm-hmm.
thing is beautiful because it stays how it is, and
mm-hmm.
you can turn it over,
right.
and then turn it back again. It's just like how it was, and then you turn it over, you know, and
yeah.
I wanted to make that, and so... I had been trying to make, like, the 3D files for it for some time, and I actually had the compilable files for it before I got the printer. And when I got the printer, I was ready, and I started printing all the knots. So it started for knots.
Mm-hmm. And then grew from there.
And then it grew from there, and then it got crazy because we opened up a 3D printing lab in the math department. We had 3 printers. Now we have 4 printers in there. And I took over the bike room. It made everybody that bikes to school is furious with me because now they have to put their bikes outside, and like taking the bike room to put 3D printers in. And then they were furious. But I think their bikes got wet outside. And And then, you know, I had all these math students who were 3D printing, and then my calculus students wanted to do 3D printing, but they weren't math students. You know, some of them were geology, biology, mm-hmm. computer science, right. engineering. Well, engineering people, they were all set because engineering had their own thing. Mm-hmm. But so then I wanted to have 3D printing sort of for everybody. And so then we had to make a whole 3D printing classroom. So now I've got 11 3D printers in this classroom, and it's a general education classroom. And so people make things that aren't mathematical at all. They just make whatever they want. And then there's a lot of math in the making.
Mm-hmm.
You know, like they have to actually think about three-dimensional geometry, or if they're coding it up, then they need to know a lot about angles and things. And it just turned into this monster.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody wants to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Are there particular objects that are favorites of yours?
I'm just so in love with the Menger sponge. I'm so excited that we can print that now.
Mm-hmm.
And that was great because there's a collaboration with someone online that I didn't even know.
Mm-hmm.
And so we would go back and forth talking about, you know, what if you did it this way? And then he came up with this great stand for printing it, but he didn't own a printer, so he couldn't turn around a copy really fast. So he would send the copy to me and I would print it, and just it was great. The whole online community of people who 3D print things is great. There's another person I've been corresponding with that I also don't know at all, and he makes a lot of polygonal meshes on knots.
Mm-hmm.
So he doesn't know knot theory, but he knows how to code these polygonal meshes.
Mm-hmm.
And I know the knot theory, but I'm really clueless about how to code these meshes. So he gives me code, and then, you know, I don't know. It's mostly, when I say collaborate, I mean other people are smarter than I am and they were willing to speak to me. I don't
mm-hmm.
want to overstate my role
mm-hmm.
in this because I'm the newbie. So.
But it sounds like you're daring. You'll just jump into something and try it and see what happens.
That would be a very positive spin on what I do. I think I'm actually just really reckless. But yes, I would like to be daring.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't really care. The nice thing about having tenure is you don't really need to care what other people are going to think about what you do. I mean, so I publish papers, but I don't have to if I don't want to.
Mm-hmm.
I just want to.
Mm-hmm.
But if people don't like them, I don't care. And I don't think I really cared before tenure either, which was, that part was maybe reckless. But
mm-hmm.
then I remember after getting tenure, being in the parking lot after Math Fest, or I don't remember which one it was, and I was talking to my husband, and I said, you know what I want to do? I want to do recreational math, because
mm-hmm.
that is awesome,
mm-hmm.
and it's interesting, and nobody can stop me now, you know? Like, I can do anything I want. I don't have to write about churn classes of singular varieties if I don't want to. I could just not. And that was exciting, to just make up new stuff.
So if you were looking, say, 5 years ahead, what kinds of things would you want to be doing?
That's an interesting question. You know what I want to do? I want to do something that I can't even imagine what it is right now. That's what I want to do.
Uh-huh.
So I inherently can't
uh-huh.
answer your question. Because uh-huh. I hope that there'll be something really cool to learn. And I like learning like the beginning of something,
mm-hmm.
you know? So like 3D printing is very new. And even just like, how do I take a parametric equation and make it into something that this 3D printer knows how to deal with. That's not inherently math, but for me it was as difficult, if not more, than doing math, because that's not my thing usually. So I would like to be doing things that get everybody excited about math and that are very difficult for me personally to figure out, even if it's not difficult for other people.
Mm-hmm.
It just does, I don't care, but as long as it's something that's hard for me, and then I can try to explain that hard thing to somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
I don't really care what the thing is, though. I feel like I should have a better answer when I have thought of a thing, but I don't know. I have no idea.
It seems to be a consistent theme, though, through
of not knowing.
That's
true.
Trying things again, but wanting it to be hard, though.
Yeah, for me, yeah. But a lot of everything is hard for me, so it's not really that hard for me to find things that are hard, because I don't think I'm actually very good at anything that I do, which is what ironically makes me good at explaining what I do, right? I mean, I think if I was good at stuff, I would be a crappy writer,
mm-hmm.
you know? Yeah, I do a lot of things badly. Yeah, which is fine.
And that's appreciated by a lot of others.
Students. Yeah, they don't really seem to mind.
And so on, yeah.
Yeah, and students especially. I mean, they're new, and they are excited. I don't have to be an expert on everything to give them a stool to stand on mm-hmm. so that they can see farther. You know what I mean?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
They should be able to... I was actually talking to someone in art about this the other day, and she said, I want my students, by the end of the semester, to be more expert than me in the thing that they're working on. And mm-hmm. I kind of feel the same way. Like, the...
Mm-hmm.
I just had to show them, like, a direction to start,
right.
You know. It's kind of hard to fall off the R1 train, though, even now. You know what I mean? Like,
yes.
Even saying that,
yeah.
To me, it even sounds less than, you know?
Mm-hmm.
Like, there's that
right.
guilt that I'm not doing
mm-hmm.
high-powered, I haven't done high-powered mathematics in the same way
mm-hmm.
That I used to for a long time. And I like this, and I like what I do, but there's always that...
Mm-hmm.
I don't know, maybe it's like being a musician and you know you're never going to be a rock star.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
You're never going to be, like, the best piano player or... I don't know. There's a lot of pressure in our community to stay on that train, I think.
But the problem is that it's, at least to my mind, a very narrowly focused train.
Yeah.
And it really isn't as expansive. It just follows tracks that have been laid out by... predecessors
mm-hmm.
and
unless you're
on.
Like a total genius, and then you maybe forge a new path, I guess.
If you're lucky.
If
yes.
you're lucky.
Yes.
But I think I figured out at some point that I like doing hard problems, but I don't like when they take 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's too long
right.
for me. And frankly, that's exactly what my undergraduate advisor told me, now that I think about it.
Yeah.
And I ignored what he said.
Right.
But so I like a project that I can actually figure out the darn thing before I get gray hairs, you know? Like, before
right.
it, you know, time
right.
passes, I should be able to figure this thing out.
Mm-hmm.
It's funny how that still feels less than, though. Even though I'm really happy with what I do, it's hard.
Mm-hmm.
It's just hard.
Mm-hmm.
I see a lot of people go through this transition, actually. And it's hard for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Good. Well.
Yeah. But I'm happy. I really like what I do.
Mm-hmm.
And it's much more interesting to me, actually. And I think it has more an effect, actually, on the universe to talk about things that
mm-hmm.
more than those 10 people will understand.
Right.
You know? So, I can be happy with that.
Good. All right. Thank you.